ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From Kyiv to Gaza, Pope Francis is having his fingers burned as he tries to be a peacemaker. Hello there, it's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West on RN and ABC Listen. And later, why have so many American evangelicals fallen hard for Vladimir Putin? Now, did Pope Francis really tell Ukraine's leaders to hoist the white flag and end a war that Russia escalated 2 years ago with a full-scale invasion? He's triggered anger in Kyiv with his call to begin negotiations. But he's not the only Western leader to suggest it. Claire Giangrave is Rome correspondent for the Religion News Service. Claire, welcome. So I gather the Vatican is now trying to walk back the statements by Pope Francis.
In a bit of a disorderly fashion, I have to admit. On one side, we have Vatican spokesperson Matteo Bruni, who sent out a statement that was published on Vatican news outlets, on several other news outlets as well, just clarifying that Pope Francis never meant the white flag as surrendering, even though that can be a bit confusing. He sort of tried to push the interpretation that Pope Francis was actually trying to encourage a peaceful negotiation. And the white flag was more of a metaphor in the sense that just stop the war, stop the deaths. On the other hand, you know, you have this very complex circle of Vatican diplomats with decades of experience in trying to negotiate peace in several parts of the world who are also trying to make amends. Now, we've seen this happen before. I think now, for example, of Cardinal Pietro Parolin, who is the second in command at the Vatican, but also a big diplomat.
What's Parolin said?
Parolin, for example, said, yes, it's true, the Pope is absolutely correct. We need to find a peace, but the peace can only happen if the aggressor first stops attacking Ukraine. So the first move needs to come from Russia. So he's trying to fix up the problem, especially after the uproar that followed the Pope's comments.
Yeah, I think the Vatican sort of was quick to point out that the phrase about the white flag was actually used by the interviewer from Swiss television, that, you know, the Pope was really just using a phrase that had been put to him.
Yes, I mean, we've seen this happen a lot at the Vatican. For us who follow the Vatican and the Pope every day, we've become very accustomed with a Pope who, when he speaks to people, he's very pastoral and he doesn't worry too much about how these words can be interpreted, even in the greater context of his diplomacy efforts to try and mediate peace. We've seen this happen in cases of talking to Palestinians and talking to the people of Israel. So this is nothing new for us. And of course, the Vatican is trying to come up with an excuse. But if you listen to the actual interview, which we already have some parts that are available to us, it's open for interpretation.
Yeah. You know, it comes across to me, Claire, that the Pope doesn't like to openly disagree with people. He likes to get on with people, but this can have diplomatic consequences.
I mean, I think you're right. In a sense, Pope Francis has this pastoral approach where he wants to be close to the people. On the other hand, though, there's something else at play here. The negotiation efforts proposed by the Holy See have, let's admit it, been a failure 2 years into the war. It's pretty clear that Ukraine and Russia, well, maybe Russia a little bit more, are not that interested in the Holy See mediating a peace. So on one hand, this is a loss for Pope Francis on the diplomatic front. But on the other, maybe it gives him the freedom to speak more candidly. And that requires for us, for both viewers, but also for people faithful, to kind of understand how does Pope Francis look at this conflict. Let's not forget that when the war started, the first thing that Pope Francis did was he broke protocol, jumped on a car, and ran to the Russian embassy. The first line of communication for Pope Francis was not Zelensky, it was Kirill, with whom he had been trying to build, long Kirill is the patriarch of the Orthodox Church in Russia, of course, build a relationship. That had been a tremendous effort that Pope Francis had worked. He was the first pope to meet with the Russian patriarch when they met at the airport in Havana, Cuba.
Yeah. And so, when he went to the Russian embassy, I mean, you and I talked about this last year. It's worth recalling. He went to tell the Russians they were wrong.
Yes. He said, please stop this madness. But he obviously thinks that communication and dialogue with Russia is essential to figuring out a peace.
Yeah.
I don't think Pope Francis denies Russia is the aggressor, but he obviously seems to believe that demonizing Russia for him, you know, the Argentinian Pope, which says a lot, is not an option.
Yeah. You referred to that effort, and we covered it last year with your help, that there was a very concerted effort by the Vatican, initially in secret, to try to negotiate peace between Ukraine and Russia. I mean, they did send that very accomplished peace broker, Cardinal Matteo Zuppi, to Kyiv and Moscow and Washington, D.C., and it was real shuttle diplomacy. I've often wondered, did that fail on religious grounds, in the sense that what was a Catholic envoy going to say to two Eastern Orthodox countries that have no religious interest in listening to the Vatican?
Every diplomat in the world would agree that the Vatican still has a certain moral weight. And also, let's not forget, you mentioned this, Zuppi is a very experienced and well-versed diplomat, and he has worked in peace missions, and he has behind him an organization, the Sant'Egidio Movement, that has decades of experience in peace building. But your question was, has it failed? You know, religiously, these two countries don't really care that much about what the Pope is going to say. Well, to a certain extent, let's be honest, the majority is Orthodox. And on the other hand, there might be more interested, and they've said this, in the humanitarian aid that the Vatican can provide. But if we're talking about the possibility of the Vatican actually being a mediator in the peace, as it has been, for example, in many conflicts in Africa, I'm thinking about some situations, including in a way South Sudan, but also Congo, I think we can pretty much say that at this moment, this is a failure. And it's been mostly Ukraine saying that they're not very interested, and partly because the Pope keeps playing this game of not being completely clear and open about calling out Russia and its leader, President Putin, as the aggressor and as a violator of human rights.
If the Vatican's efforts as a peacemaker have stalled, if not outright failed, if they've stalled, maybe there is a case, though, that this is the Vatican as truth teller, because as hard as it is for the people of Ukraine, who've suffered enormously at Russia's hands, to hear this, the Pope is not the only figure in international politics who's saying that this will have to end via negotiation. I've just read statements by the foreign minister of Italy and various US senators. Yeah. He's not alone.
No, he's not alone. I'm sure, though, that he faces the same kind of criticism. Perhaps the question is the wording. The German synod, the German bishops, answered by this statement by saying that the Pope poorly chose his words. And it's true that white flag has a connotation. It's one of those powerful world and international diplomatic circles that really can be troublesome if you think about the 500,000 people who died on both sides of this conflict. It's very hard 2 years in to talk about white flags. But, you know, at the same time, the church in Ukraine that is not in support of Pope Francis, even the Catholic Church there, doesn't look to him and his commentary on the war favorably. And Ukraine seems to be pretty dead set on continuing, or at least, you know, if it's going to go to the negotiation table, by no means it will be underneath a white flag.
Claire Giangrave, she's the Religion News Service correspondent in the Vatican. Thanks for coming back to the program, Claire.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
And this is the Religion and Ethics Report, where you're hearing about the links between religion and the news that's shaping the world. Pope Francis hasn't just annoyed Ukraine's leaders by suggesting they need to start negotiating an end to the war with Russia. Vatican officials have also upset the government of Israel. They've suggested the military retaliation in Gaza has become a disproportionate response to the Hamas massacre of October 7. Paul Eli is a research fellow at Georgetown University and a contributing writer to The New Yorker.
The tension between Israel and the Vatican really has two dimensions. The first has to do with statements by the Vatican Secretary of State, Pope Francis, that seem to call Israel out for a lack of proportionality in its response to the murderous attack on Israelis on October 7th. The second part has to do with language of the Pope, which builds on language of his two predecessors, which really asks us to consider whether even a just war is worth fighting and whether war is really the answer.
I'm going to come back to that question of a just war in a moment, but what have the Israelis said?
The current dispute began when Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, coming out of an event in Rome, suggested that a just war has to be fought with a proportionate response from the wounded party, and that Israel's campaign in Gaza with nearly 30,000 dead is not proportional. We elicited a response from the Israeli embassy, which deplored the comment, "How dare the Vatican criticize Israel in this moment of incredible tension?" And things went south from there.
I mean, considerably south, because at the start of this conflict, the Vatican made clear its revulsion at what had occurred by Hamas. But the Vatican has, in some respects, been criticized for not taking a side or not explicitly taking a side, hasn't it, Paul?
It's not the first time that that's happened. We saw some of this with Russia's war on Ukraine. Pope Francis was pressed for being insufficiently specific or not naming the aggressor and so forth. And I think there was some justification for that. But in this case, Pope Francis called out the attack on October 7th right away. And shortly afterward, both he and Parolin, his closest deputy in the diplomatic sphere, acknowledged that Israel had the right to respond. Some of the problems arose from the fact that, first of all, they often use somewhat opaque language in doing this. They'll talk about the two sides of the two parties. And second of all, they do strive for a kind of balance or even-handedness. So when the Pope or Parolin acknowledges Israel's right to self-defense, often in the same breath it acknowledges the suffering of the Palestinian people. And that even-handedness is often seen, let's say, by the Israeli embassy as kind of equivocation or moral equivalence between two sides.
I mean, speaking of even-handedness, Pope Francis has met relatives of the Israeli hostages who've been taken by Hamas. He's also met with the relatives of Palestinians who've been killed by Israeli bombs and some who are now in Israeli jails. Has this even-handedness got him anywhere?
Well, I don't think that Pope Francis is really trying to get somewhere with these gestures. He's got considerable moral authority as the Pope. On top of that, part of his particular charisma as Pope is to be pastoral, to meet people at their moment of need, to show the care and concern of the Vatican, and to have that be witnessed by the world. That's what he did in a single day, meeting with relatives of hostages held by Hamas, Israeli hostages, and relatives of Palestinians since either killed or held in jails by Israel. The very attempt to meet with both sides caused trouble in both directions. The Israeli embassy was irked, and the Palestinians claimed that he'd used the word genocide in conversation with them, but whatever he said didn't make it into general circulation. His spokesman denied it.
You've said in this fascinating piece that you've written for The New Yorker, and we'll put a link to it at our website, that the Pope is essentially having difficulty finding a role in the Gaza conflict. Why is that?
What you alluded to earlier, the reluctance to take a side often leads to being on the sidelines. But more than that, what I tried to do with the piece was to suggest that it seems that the Pope has no role, but then to come around to suggesting what role the Pope actually has, and the Pope is progressively more and more firmly carrying out. And it's this. The first thing is to try to be specific about what's happening. The Vatican doesn't have a particularly good record on this score. They use euphemism and loquacious statements that will do everything but call a terrorist act a terrorist act. So I invite the Pope and the Vatican to name things more clearly than they do. At the same time, and I mentioned this at the top of the conversation, in this moment, there are very few world leaders who are speaking out against war as such. Everybody's taking a side. Everybody feels the cause that they're supporting as just. And so the whole question of whether war really solves anything, whether war is anything but an effort to kind of stain the world with blood, as Pope Francis put it, that question doesn't really come up. So it's vital that at least the Pope has the role. He's able to say, war is not the answer. Brothers, lay down your arms.
And this goes back to the point that you made earlier, which I just found so interesting, and that is, why is Pope Francis effectively rethinking a centuries-old Catholic doctrine, a centuries-old Christian doctrine of just war? He's not the first to do it, but he seems to be doing it in the most explicit way, and it really is overturning a very long-term thinking. Why is he doing it? How is he doing it?
It's a good question, and colleagues of mine at Georgetown have spent their careers watching this development. The just war, as you say, it's a very old Christian tradition that for a war to be just, it must be response to an offense, it must be proportionate, and it must be a last resort, that you've tried diplomacy and other things first. Pope Francis, building on his predecessors, now says, that sounds good, but in our current situation, often it's not clear who's making war on whom because of terrorist groups and non-state actors. So how can a war be proportionate when it's a nation with a giant army against a terrorist cell? And then, because there's always the possibility of a regional war breaking out into nuclear war, the whole idea of proportionality is kind of absurd. If some country uses nuclear weapons, there's no sensible way to think of that as a proportional response. So with all that in mind, Pope Francis is saying this just war theory has become too easy, kind of a dodge. It enables parties to say our war is just instead of asking, again, the question of whether war gets us anywhere.
Now, if Pope Francis is struggling in a way to find a role in the Gaza conflict, one person who isn't, and we've spoken about him on this program before, is the cardinal who's based in Jerusalem. That's Cardinal Pisabella. Tell me about what Cardinal Pisabella has done, because most dramatically last year we reported that he offered to take the place of the children as hostages. But more recently, I think he's actually upset the Israelis for one symbolic act, didn't he?
So shortly before Christmas, about a month after the offer you mentioned, in which he suggested that he would become a hostage if Hamas would release some of the children that they're holding, he would gain their freedom by relinquishing his own. So that was in November. A month later, the holy time of year for both Christians and Jews, or a holy time of year, he took part in a visit to the Israeli president's official residence with a number of other Christian leaders. And then a couple of days later, he entered a church, I believe it was in Bethlehem, for Christmas Eve services wearing keffiyeh, the scarf that is a symbol for many people of Palestinian liberation. It was a striking image that he's a cardinal. He had very traditional Catholic vestments on, and then this scarf that means something very different.
And how did Israelis react, or how did, you know, certain Israeli leaders react to that?
He said in an interview that I write about in the article and has said elsewhere, is an attempt to strike a balance is seen by official Israelis as a false equivalence, that you can't support both sides. You have to support one side more than the other. And it's our side that deserves your support. If you stray from that path, you're being unfair. You're not recognizing the justice of our cause, where he, very much in the manner of Pope Francis, is trying to recognize the justice of each side's grievances and support them both.
Just finally, Paul, over the past decade, am I right in thinking that the Vatican has actually been leading a movement or a tendency in Western countries to recognize a state of Palestine?
I don't know what the knock-on effect of the Vatican's actions are, but the Vatican recognized a Palestinian state in 2015, and this, too, was an occasion for dismay from the Israeli embassy. They suggested that this was not going to advance the peace process, that Palestine is not a state or deserving the recognition of statehood at this point. It was complicated by the fact that the Vatican did not recognize the state of Israel until much later than most of Western countries, 1993, I believe it is. So there's a history of bitterness about how cautious the Vatican was in recognizing the state of Israel, and then from the Israelis' point of view, how precipitate it was in recognizing an incipient state of Palestine that doesn't quite exist on the ground from their point of view.
Paul Eli of Georgetown University and The New Yorker, and you're with me, Andrew West. In case you missed the news, it wasn't really news as such because the result was never in doubt. There were parliamentary elections in Iran recently. The religious hardliners swept to victory, but voter turnout was a record low, about 40%, according to Chatham House in London. There's another election at the moment, and just like in Iran, the regime is all but certain to win. Russians will vote in a presidential poll that will likely keep Vladimir Putin in power until at least 2030. Now, they don't have a vote, but some of Putin's biggest cheerleaders are American evangelicals. So how has an ex-KGB agent who's threatening the West with nuclear war become a hero to nominally conservative Christians? Dr. Michael Bird is vice principal at Ridley, an evangelical college in Melbourne. He explores this phenomenon in an essay for ABC Religion and Ethics Online.
Well, they do it a number of ways. They've got a genuine sense of affection for anyone who's vaguely Christian and has got a lot of machismo, who's got a strong arm and believes you've just got to go in there, crack some skulls and get things done. So that type of persona is very attractive to a certain political constituency in America. In addition to that, they see Putin as someone who is standing up for his nation, his Russian Orthodox religion, over and against the American liberals and the somewhat secularizing people of Western Europe. So he's very much of a champion of maintaining your values, your religion, and being a patriot.
You said there, anyone who's vaguely Christian, do US evangelicals accept that Vladimir Putin might be simply vaguely Christian?
Yeah, and for a lot of them, that is good enough. They don't mind someone who's nominally Christian, who pays at least, you know, verbal lip service or Christian in a very cultural sense, but, you know, Christmas and Easter were the only services they'd go to. As long as someone kind of recognizes that Christianity should be culturally hegemonic, they're not really all that concerned whether they're particularly pious or devout in their personal and private life.
Yeah, I ask this because, you know, as we get deeper into a US election year, it's the same principle that appears to apply to Donald Trump and his relations with US evangelicals.
And that's exactly right. And I remember in the early days when Trump was running in 2016 and when he won the nomination, there was a very prominent Southern Baptist called Russell Moore. He said, the religious right is now supporting the people who the religious right warned us about. And that was the great irony, since, you know, there was a huge uproar about the immorality of Bill Clinton and his ill fitness to be president, but they all seemed to push that under the carpet when they had their own strongman in power.
Mm. But more to the point in the case of Russia, and you bring this out in your essay for the ABC Religion and Ethics website, for a long time US evangelicals saw Russia in its Soviet incarnation, and I should point that out, in its Soviet incarnation, as the harbinger of doom. They saw it as godless, evil communism, didn't they? Have they convinced themselves that there's been this radical sea change in Russia?
Very much so. So I think Russia has gone from being Gog and Magog of biblical prophecy, this godless army from the east that tries to fight the Lord of hosts. Russia has gone from that to sort of the final expression of a Constantinian Christianity, that marriage between the state and the church that brings the two together in a symphony of political religion. They see Russia very much holding on as the last vestige of Christendom. The nature of religious belief, I think most American evangelicals have no idea what Orthodox Christians even believe. The very nature of belief and the depth of that belief doesn't seem to matter all that much, as long as Christianity is symbolically in charge, revered in some way. That seems to be all that matters to a great many of them.
Well, Michael, this is fascinating because evangelicals, especially in the US, or evangelicals who model themselves on the US style, they're actually pretty deeply suspicious of Anglicans or Protestants who do no more than use a prayer book and sing traditional hymns and wear basic clerical clothing. So how do they make common cause with the Orthodox Church, which is highly ritualistic and highly mystical?
I know. I mean, that's the great irony behind it. You know, people who don't like all that paraphernalia of written prayers and robes and golden chalices or anything, they all seem to put that to the side when it comes to making political overtures towards unity and common cause with someone. So yeah, it's being against a secularizing or progressive agenda makes very strange religious bedfellows.
Mm. In the closed society that Russia has become, a lot of people will have forgotten, though, what happened with evangelicals after the end of the Soviet Union in 1991.
There was a long-standing tradition of religious dissent in Russia, both amongst the Orthodox churches, but also amongst various Protestant groups who were able to stay under the radar for a bit. But many were persecuted, sent to gulags, many were executed, put in prison for decades. So there was a long tradition of religious dissent. There was a very famous story of a bunch of Russian Pentecostals who were basically holed up in the American embassy in Moscow for a number of years before Gorbachev and Reagan kind of negotiated a deal to get them out. So there was this long tradition of Protestants being there. When the Iron Curtain came down, when the Soviet Union somewhat disintegrated, there was this great influx then of all different religious groups coming into Russia. I mean, Billy Graham went and visited, did a big, you know, evangelistic crusade in Moscow. And there was a great time of openness to the West, a big exchange of ideas going both ways. And, you know, I won't say necessarily an evangelical renewal, but there was a new spirit of openness to spiritual things, which had hitherto been closed off in the Soviet Union for a number of decades.
Russia, though, does both prescribe and proscribe certain religions. And this is what does surprise me about some of this intense evangelical support from the United States. There are Christians that Putin won't tolerate, though, aren't there?
That's right. He is very much pro-Russian Orthodox, and the Orthodox don't like evangelical groups. They don't like some, you know, more sectarian groups like Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons too. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of significant number of Baptists in Russia. There is a Russian Protestant church, and many of them are divided as well. Should they be good patriotic Christians, be committed to the Russia, if not necessarily the leader, but at least be, you know, Russian Baptists? Or there are also those who want a separation from the state and are worried that too closely aligning themselves with the state may well be to their detriment. I mean, historically speaking, Baptists have normally favored the separation of church and state. So even amongst Protestant groups, there is the same sort of tension of how pro-Russia they should be, or whether they should distance themselves at least a little bit from the Russian regime.
I guess more to the point, how has the Russian Orthodox Church made its peace, or even this compact with Putin, who is a former KGB apparatchik?
I think you've got to go back to the earlier Tsarist period, where the motto was orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationalism. So for a big chunk of Russia's history, national identity, national religion, and a national dictator were all together in a kind of trinity of Russian power. What Putin is really doing is going back to the status quo of the pre-Soviet era, where religion was not really separate from the state, and where the state invested all of its power in a single dictator, or at least a single autocrat. So in terms of Russian history, it is kind of situation normal.
I have, in trying to understand the affection that many evangelicals in the US have for Putin, thought about it this way. Look, they're looking around at their own society, and this has been sanctioned by a number of Protestant churches in the United States, which have moved in a very, very liberal direction. Do they just think, look, Putin is the bulwark against this? Yes, he's a dictator of another country, but somehow he's useful to us in our culture war struggle?
I think that's exactly right. They see Putin as a figure who resists the progressive mores of Western Europe. And I've actually heard people say things like, there's no gay pride parades in Russia, as if that is the single metric which you should be concerned with. They're not terribly worried about the lack of democracy, the violation of human rights, the brutality and the illegal invasion of Ukraine. They're really just concerned with the lack of gay pride parades. So, I mean, it's that kind of mentality that you're dealing with. For many of them, Russia is the symbol of resistance against Western liberalism.
Just as we wind up, Michael, I'm going to speak with you about this at a later date, but you have co-written with Tom Wright this fascinating book called Jesus and the Powers. Now, it's a look at the Christian political tradition. When I think of the Christian political tradition, I'm thinking of the late 19th and early 20th centuries when the social gospel movement shaped the left, arguably much more than Marxism did. But then I'm also thinking after World War II, through Christian democracy, how the Christian political tradition shaped those parties on the centre-right that were much more committed to the common good than they were to private gain. What has corrupted the Christian political tradition?
I think it's very different in different parts of the world. You know, obviously, the closer you get in proximity to power, the more of the temptation there is to either compromise your beliefs or else to do whatever it takes to remain in power. But I like to remember the tradition of people like William Wilberforce or William Temple, a former Archbishop of Great Britain, or people like Martin Luther King or a great many others who have been politically involved and believed that Christianity could be a force for public good. And they did it without trying to engage any self-aggrandizement, without trying to enrich themselves, or without trying to turn Christianity purely into religious capital for their own political machinations. So it's very much that tradition that my co-author Tom and I are trying to recapture in that book.
We'll talk about that when we speak to you again in a few weeks. It's been terrific to speak with you. The Reverend Dr. Mike Bird, he is at Ridley College in Melbourne. The book that we've just referred to is called Jesus and the Powers. But for now, Mike is the author of a very interesting essay that's on the ABC Religion and Ethics website about the evangelical affection for Vladimir Putin. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Great. Thank you for having me, Andrew, and to be with all your listeners.
And that is the show for now. You can find us at ABC Listen, where I would love you to follow us. A big thanks to Hong Jiang and Craig Tilmouth. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.